we have quite a store of negative karma on our mind stream from past misdeeds done under the influence of self-grasping ignorance and the self-centered attitude. So, of course, hindrances arise. Suffering arises. It becomes difficult to listen to teachings. It becomes impossible even to meet the Buddha Dharma. Or it becomes problematic to understand the teachings. So understanding that whatever obstacles we face are due to causes, and causes are impermanent phenomena, so they can be altered, or the karmic seeds that they leave can be altered before they bring a result. So knowing this, when we face various obstacles, instead of getting discouraged, then do purification practice. And do it wholeheartedly, really regretting whatever misdeeds we may have committed in the past. And having a strong determination to avoid them again in the future. And then in that way, begin to transform our behavior on a day-to-day basis, improve our motivation, create a more virtuous karma that leaves the seeds of virtue on our mind stream that will bring good results, especially if we dedicate them so that we can have all the conducive conditions to meet and practice the Dharma. So seeing that this is the situation of all sentient beings, everybody's mind being overwhelmed and by the afflictions and the polluted karma. And instead of being angry at them when things happen, to have compassion, because they're under the influence of their afflictions. And their afflictions harm them as much as their afflictive behavior harms us. And so in that way develop a strong intention to eliminate suffering, no matter whose it is, because we all are overwhelmed by our afflictions and karma, controlled by them. Doesn't matter whose dukkha it is, something to be eliminated. And so in that way, develop compassion, develop love, develop the intention to bring about the welfare of sentient beings. And let that motivate you to really access your Buddha potential and progress on the path. So how much when we look at other living beings who are going through various experiences or doing various actions, how much do we look at them and say, oh, there's a suffering sentient being overwhelmed by afflictions and karma? And how much do we say, oh, that's Joe, and that's Cindy, without any of this kind of mind that really sees the situation that they're stuck in? Yeah. And how much do we expect Joe and Cindy to, you know, get it together and act differently? When we can't even, you know, we have this, like, why are they doing this ridiculous thing? And yet, you know, they're overwhelmed by afflictions and karma, so of course they're doing something ridiculous. And maybe we're overwhelmed by afflictions and karma, and that's why we're thinking such a ridiculous thought, that they should be doing something different, like they should be perfect. You know? It's funny, isn't it? Like, you know, they should just get it together. And yet, our misdeeds, you know, always have good excuses, good reasons. You know, so on and so forth. Okay, so it can be very helpful to train the mind to see people like this. You know, and when we're outside and there's different bugs, just, or inside and there's different bugs, and just, you know, that's a sentient being who is born in that kind of body, trapped in that kind of body by the force of their karma. Yeah, and how sad that is. And especially if we think, you know, that person has been somebody very dear to me in the past. And now, look, you know, look at their situation. So that can be very helpful in broadening our mind and, you know, learning to see things in a different way, see our experience around us through the perspective of the Buddhist worldview instead of through the perspective of our self-centered mind and all of its expectations about how things should be. So last week we were talking about faith and wisdom, remember? And I had to stop in the middle of a section. So I'll just go back. We were talking about three kinds of faith. So one was aspiring faith. No, he put the first one. Admiring faith, where we admire the qualities of the Buddha, Dharma Sangha, of different spiritual practitioners, of people who are good role models for us, and how by seeing their good qualities, it really inspires us. Dipten Jinpa just wrote a new biography of Tsongkhapa that's going to come out soon. Yeah, and so that will get to see a little bit more about how he practiced. Then there's aspiring faith that aspires to develop these good qualities. And then believing faith. And His Holiness was explaining believing faith as of two kinds. So the first one He says the first believes the truth of the Buddha's teachings because they were taught by the Buddhas and our spiritual mentors, and we trust them. Okay, so this faith may arise due to reasons that we have only partially verified or without applying reasoning. So there's some reasons behind the believing faith, but they may not be very stable and they may not be based on logic. They may be based more on I trust this person or I trust what the Buddha says or something like that. Okay, and then the second type of believing faith is that depends on having conviction because we've really checked the teachings out, you know, and we've examined them with logic, we've practiced them, we've engaged with them. And so because of our experience gained either through practice or through reasoning, then we have faith in them, faith or confidence in them. So that kind of believing faith is a lot more stable. And that's the kind that we want to cultivate in order to make ourselves into a sharp faculty practitioner. Okay, and so now we're at the part towards the bottom of the page of 195. Okay, and where it says Tsongkhapa illustrates the second type of believing faith arising from reason in his praise to dependent arising. So there he says, having seen the truth, you taught it. Those following you will leave all troubles far behind. They will cut to the root of every fault. So those three lines could inspire the first kind of believing faith. That the, you know, Tsongkhapa said that, and he's praising the Buddha. And so because we have faith in Tsongkhapa, faith in the Buddha, we believe it. But if we keep reading, the second verse shows, you know, that there's reasoning behind having this faith in the Buddha. Okay, so there Tsongkhapa says, however, those outside your teachings, though they practice long and hard, are those who beckon back faults, for they are welded to views of self. Ah, when the wise see the difference, how could they not revere you from the very depths of their heart? And so here, you know, why is Tsongkhapa revering the Buddha? It's because the Buddha has explained the teachings on selflessness. And Tsongkhapa has meditated on those teachings. And he's seen how they free the mind. And he sees how non-Buddhist practitioners who are welded to grasping at the self, how they suffer. Yeah. And so because of his conviction in selflessness gained by examining the teachings that the Buddha taught with reasoning, then he praises the Buddha. Okay? Is that clear? He doesn't give the reasoning and everything here. But you can see by the way he praises the Buddha, it's because he's used reasoning to understand.
Yeah. So is it the case that someone who arrives at believing faith, that they don't have the other two, or is it possible for all three of them to coexist in the same?
Oh yeah, we want to have all three. Yeah. It's not that it's not a progression, and you dump the earlier ones to get the later ones, because we want to admire the good qualities of the holy beings. We want to aspire to generate those good qualities ourselves, and we want to have the conviction in the teachings, especially that gained by examining them and investigating. So we want to cultivate all three kinds of faith. Okay, the second type of believing faith arises from deep conviction that is born from clearly knowing and analyzing the distinctions between the Buddha's teachings and those of masters who adhere to the views of inherent existence. So that's what Tsongkhapa was just praising there. Okay. Is that, you know, having analyzed the teachings, he could see the difference between what the Buddha taught and what the non-Buddhists taught, and through that really see the excellence in the Buddha's teachings, you know, that came from his understanding and his experience gained through hearing, thinking, and meditating on the teachings. Okay. After examining both teachings, of Buddhists and non-Buddhists, with discerning wisdom and clearly seeing the truth in the Buddha's teachings, the wise have no choice but to feel great faith, trust, and respect for the Buddha. Yeah, so if you're really thinking clearly, yeah, and you can see the beauty in the Buddha's teachings, you don't, your faith just comes. You know, you don't have to say, well, should I have faith? Should I not? What am I going to choose? It's just, it's automatically there. Tsongkhapa expresses this with these moving words. Alas, my mind was defeated by ignorance, though I've sought refuge for a long time in such an embodiment of excellence, I possess not a fraction of his qualities. Nonetheless, before the stream of this life flowing toward death has come to cease, that I have found slight faith in you, even this, I think, is fortunate. Yeah? So even having some faith in the Buddha, some trust, some confidence, that's going to lead you to take refuge in the Buddha and to really learn the teachings and practice them. Yeah, that is incredible fortune. Yeah, right then and there. And of course, it's going to take us a long time to gain the realizations. But just having the trust that will anchor us to these teachings is so fortunate. Yeah? And as you live longer and you watch people's lives and you watch how they think and you watch how they act and you watch how they try and make sense of things, you know, and then use your own intelligence to examine the Buddha's teachings, it really becomes much clearer, like how superb the teachings that the Buddha gave are. You know? I mean, right from the very get-go, the Buddha says, "Don't believe anything I say. Check it out for yourself." So that already, wow, that's good, isn't it? Instead of, "You better believe this or you're going to hell." You know, that's not the Buddha's way at all. So in the first verse that I just read, qualities refers chiefly to insight into emptiness. Because Tsongkhapa said, I possess not a fraction of his qualities. Tsongkhapa acknowledges that for a long time, ignorance has obscured his mind. Yet due to gaining some understanding of emptiness, he experienced faith based on conviction in the doctrine of emptiness taught by the Buddha with great compassion. Considering how few people encountered teachings on emptiness, and among those, how few gain even a modest understanding of it, Tsongkhapa felt fortunate to trust the truth of non-inherent existence. Pondering this will increase our aspiring faith and motivate us to practice like the Buddha did and attain the same depth of realization. Okay, so seeing Tsongkhapa's, how he generate believing faith will inspire us to have admiring faith and aspiring. Learn the teachings well and use reason to reflect on their meaning. If you do not find any logical fallacies or contradictions, you will have believing faith in the path and the possibility of attaining it. That faith, in turn, will help increase your trust in the topics that cannot be understood completely through factual inference. Yeah, topics such as the intricacies of karma and its effects. Yeah. So by understanding the teachings on emptiness and understanding teachings that are easier for us to understand by using reasoning, then that will help us trust the Buddha so that some of the teachings that, we can't prove by reasoning, you know, at least not factual reasoning, and we can't know through direct perception, then we become more open to take the Buddha's word for those teachings. So, for example, when the Buddha describes the intricacies of karma and its effects, yeah, instead of going, oh, well, you know, we'll say, well, the Buddha was, you know, trustworthy regarding this, and I studied that, and that really helped me and made sense, you know. So this other thing that the Buddha said also is very important, and we trust it and have faith in it more. Believing that actions bring concordant results is sufficient to help us curb destructive actions and act constructively, thus accumulating merit, which aids the increase of wisdom. In Buddhism, wisdom and faith are not contradictory, and when properly cultivated, they increase each other. Okay, so we may have, you know, some teachings that we think deeply about, and they make sense. So we have believing faith, yeah, and then that faith kind of moistens our mind and makes it more receptive to understand other teachings that perhaps, like I was saying before, we can't understand through reasoning or direct perception. And then by understanding those teachings, for example, understanding that actions bring concordant results on an ethical plane, then that will help us, you know, keep abandon negativities, create virtue, and doing that will help us accumulate the causes to be able to gain the wisdom realizing emptiness. Okay, so the point is that faith and wisdom complement each other. Yeah? So we shouldn't think, oh, somebody who has faith, they're just stupid, they should have wisdom. Or somebody who has wisdom, they're just intellectual, they don't have any devotion. It's not like that, okay? The two can really complement each other and help us advance. Yeah. And you can see that really in Tsongkhapa. You know, I was mentioning Thupten Jinpa's book, so he sent me a copy because he wants me to write a recommendation blurb for it. And so one of the things that, you know, and when I'm reading it, is Tsongkhapa wrote a lot of just expressions of his understandings, expression of his admiration for the Buddha, expression of admiration for his teachers. And so you see, you know, there's a lot of devotion and this kind of, you know, feeling. And yet he was somebody with this brilliant intellect. Because when you start to study his philosophical teachings, I mean, there's really something to think about because he goes into every little detail and analyzes, you know, so wisely. So he's a good example of somebody who really has both of these qualities, you know, and His Holiness as well. Yeah, His Holiness, incredible, you know, the warmth and admiration for the Buddha and the way he speaks of the Buddha. And yet His Holiness has this brilliant intellect. Yeah. So we shouldn't think of brilliant intellects as just intellectual ability. And we shouldn't think of faith as just emotion, you know. But the two can really balance and help each other. And I received some advice very early on when I first went to Kopan. There was one nun who was teaching me how to do the mandala offering. And she said, when your mind gets stuck and you just feel stuck in your practice, she said, do purification practices and practices to create merit, like the mandala offering. And she said, when you do these more devotional type of creation of merit purification practices, that eliminates a lot of the obscuration, of the hiccups, so that then you can return to your studies and really understanding what the texts are about and what your teachers are saying. So I found that to be very, very good advice. Because sometimes we get stuck, don't we?
Yeah.
We study and it feels like, I can't understand anything. So at that point, you know, stop and do some of the more faith-based practices. Then come back to your studies. Hari Bhadra, in a commentary on Maitreya's Ornament of Clear Realizations, speaks about having faith not only in the three jewels, but also in the treatises that take the three jewels as their subject matter. Okay. While many people have admiring faith in the three jewels, not many have faith in the treatises that discuss them. Yeah? And so you see, you know, kind of in general Buddhist practice, people, you know, have so much faith and go to the temple and make offerings to the Buddha and sing praises and things like that. But you ask them to study one of the treatises that are explaining the Buddha's teachings, and it's like, no, you know, I can't understand, or they're boring, or that doesn't do any good, or, you know, somehow they don't want to learn about what the three jewels are, because if you study the treatises, then you learn what the three jewels are, okay? So volume 4 that's coming out in October, the first part, the first three chapters, I think, are on refuge. And so, you know, it's really explaining in much more depth the qualities of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Yeah. And so you have to stop and think about it. And not just say, oh, well, the Buddha realized emptiness. That's point one. Point two, he has great compassion. Point three, he has power. But, you know, it really explains in some of the texts what this, you know, what emptiness the Buddha has realized and how that relates to true cessation and how that, you know, what is the kind of wisdom the Buddha had generated in order to gain that realization, and what are the qualities that come from gaining that realization. And so really learning in much more depth what the three jewels of refuge are, instead of just saying, well, I believe in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, you know. Buddha's enlightened, I believe. You know, Dharma's the path, sounds good. Sangha, yeah, they practice, good enough. You know, but to really be able to understand what the qualities are and why we take refuge in them. And then how to relate to each of the three jewels so that they can help us on the path. Okay, so while many people have admiring faith in the three jewels, not many have faith in the treatises that discuss them. Faith in the treatises and their authors leads us to study the text, which increases our knowledge of the three jewels. This, in turn, promotes contemplating and then meditating on the meaning that we learned, thereby deepening both our wisdom and believing faith. These, in turn, are essential factors for our awakening. So here His Holiness, as He often does, is giving you a whole, or giving us a whole string of cause and effect relationships. Okay? So, yeah, if you study the text and develop some rudimentary faith in the treatises and their authors, then you're going to study, that's going to result in studying the text more. That acts as a cause to increase our knowledge of the three jewels. This, in turn, brings the result of deepening both our wisdom and our believing faith. And that gives, you know, produces, you know, the essential factors for awakening in our mind. You know, so He's really tying these things together. He often does that when he teaches. It's really, I think, an amazing quality of His Holiness, why He's such a good teacher, for the way He ties different things together so that you see how they relate. Yeah. So He doesn't just say, okay, gain the essential factors for awakening. Gain those and then you'll have them. He goes through and says, okay, these are some of the things that you need to do. So there is no fixed order in which faith and wisdom arise. According to individual tendencies, faith may give rise to wisdom. Wisdom may lead to faith, or these two may occur simultaneously. Not in one consciousness, but as you're practicing in one time, you may cultivate both of them. Stabilizing our faith increases our resilience. Okay, now think about that. Why would having stable faith increase your resilience? Yeah. How does that work?
I think because you don't have so much doubt plaguing you.
You don't have so much doubt.
Yeah, you know what to practice and you don't hesitate.
Yeah. Okay. And you understand something. And so then, yeah, no one's going to be able to come and make you, you know, go into crisis and not know what you believe.
Also, with stabilizing faith, when our afflictions arise, we can kind of ride on our faith while the storm
yes.
goes a little less, and then we come out.
Yeah, our faith can carry us when our mind is going bonkers. Okay, so stable faith is not affected by the opinions of others and prevents discouragement when viewing others' wrongdoing. Now, why do you think stable faith is going to prevent discouragement when we see other people's wrongdoing? How does that work?
Understand where it came from and how it functions and how people are controlled, like you were saying at the beginning, how people are controlled by karma and afflictions.
Yeah. So we understand the source of sentient beings' misdeeds. We understand that they're controlled by afflictions and karma, that all of this has causes. Okay. Our faith in the Buddha's teachings will not falter should we find a statement in the scriptures or one said by our teacher with which we initially disagree. Instead, we will continue to investigate. So that, I think, is a very important point. Because sometimes we hear things in the teachings or our teacher says something and we go, that doesn't sound right at all, okay? And so if we just see that and say, okay, the Buddha's wrong, my teacher's wrong, the Dharma is nonsense, goodbye, you know, then who's losing out? Whereas if we have some stable faith and something comes along we don't understand, then we think, okay, I need to go back and really try and understand what the Buddha is saying here. Because it could be that I'm looking at it incorrectly and drawing the wrong conclusion. Okay. Case in point, years ago, an old Dharma student who I had known for many, many years, we were talking about the self-centered mind. And she was telling me that she went to see one of the Rinpoches who had come to her Dharma center. And she asked him, you know, she said, when I study about the faults of the self-centered mind, I feel so bad about myself for being so selfish. You know, and I really get down on myself because I think like that. And is this the way I'm supposed to feel from, you know, meditating on the disadvantages of self-centeredness? So this conversation was going on through a translator. And so the Rinpoche replied, or at least the translator said, yes, you're doing the meditation correctly. And when she told me that, I said, I don't think so, you know. I think either the translator was mistaken or the Rinpoche didn't understand what you were really asking. Okay. But, you know, if she hadn't had had some faith, because when she heard that answer, she could have easily said, well, forget the whole thing. Yeah, why do I need to study Buddhism only to feel bad about myself, like I'm incompetent and I'm guilty because I'm selfish? She could have easily thought that and said, okay, you know, goodbye. But she was a long-term student, and so she was puzzled by what the Rinpoche said. But she kept thinking about it, and then when the opportunity was there, we were talking one day, she brought it up, and then I was able to clarify that for her. Okay? So that's a really good example of how, you know, having our faith will sustain us so that we don't just criticize the Dharma when we don't understand something, because, like in that case, she was drawing the wrong conclusion from the teachings. Yeah. I mean, the Buddha certainly didn't teach the defects or the disadvantages of self-centeredness in order to make us feel guilty for being selfish. Yeah, I mean, come on. That's not, why does the Buddha need to teach us to feel guilty for being selfish? Is that a virtuous mental state? Is that a mental state that's going to help us in our practice? Yeah? So if it's not a virtuous mental state, it's not something that's going to help us in the practice, then the conclusion we're drawing from hearing that is erroneous. Okay. So we have to go back. And so, okay, when the Buddha talks about the disadvantages of self-centeredness, what is he actually trying to get me to think? You know, what actually is the purpose of this teaching? It's not to make me hate myself, because I can do that without going to Dharma teachings, you know? So what is the Buddha trying to teach me? Oh, the Buddha's trying to say, when you're unhappy, yeah, look and see how your self-centered mind is involved and how your self-centered mind lies behind the afflictions that make you create negative karma, that bring you suffering, you know? So the Buddha's trying to help, to give us a window to understand the causes of our own confusion and our own misery. That's why he's teaching this, yeah? So that we'll see that the self-centered mind is our enemy, you know, and recognize it's not our friend, and so to stop letting it control our lives. That's what the Buddha's, you know, trying to get across to us. Okay? So, you know, to be really careful when we meditate on different teachings, to check and see, are we really coming to the right conclusion? Because if we're coming out feeling discouraged or angry or full of doubt or something like that, then somehow we're not understanding the point. Yeah? And the point of some of the teachings sometimes may be difficult to understand. It may be above our head at the moment, okay? But we can still, you know, come back to it from time to time and think about it and eventually gain the correct understanding. Okay, then there's the reflection, so what you should think about. So find examples in your own experience of the three types of faith. So this is your longer meditation for tomorrow morning. Yeah, and two, how does each one of those three types of faith contribute to your internal happiness? And three, how can you gently increase your faith and trust in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha? Okay. And the next section is proper practice. So remember, this chapter is called Tools for the Path. So, you know, various things that will help us understand how to practice better. This is a good section here. Yeah, I've heard His Holiness speak on this a lot. I'm concerned that these days people rely too much on admiring faith and even then do not understand or cultivate it properly. Some people have great devotion but minimal interest in study. Many years ago, I went to Singapore, and the Buddhists there greeted me with so much devotion. Some of them touched my clothes or my body, believing that they would receive some blessing. But when I explained the Buddha Dharma, few of them were interested. Okay? And I remember in Mountain View when His Holiness gave teaching some years ago, and, you know, and then gave a medicine Buddha, Jainong, afterwards. Lots of people came to the medicine Buddha, Jainong, and not nearly as many to the teachings. And His Holiness scolded people at the Jainong and said, you people should come to the teachings. There should be more people at the teachings than at the Jainong. Yeah. And I really see this in many places I go, just people... Yeah, it's really like the less they understand, the more faith they have. Yeah. And then what do they ask for? They ask for Jainongs, they ask for Lungs, they ask for things. You know, they don't want to hear teachings on karma. They don't want to hear teachings on, you know, the four truths. Yeah, they just want, you know, maybe to do the practice of the wealth deity, yeah. Like give us the lung for that, and then we can do some of those practices. Or, you know, let's make some wealth vases, or let's, you know, do these kinds of things. And oh, then so many people come. Yeah, some places you go, so many people come for that kind of stuff. Yeah. But, you know, to come and hear about precepts or hear about emptiness, it's like, no. I prefer, this is His Holiness speaking, I prefer when people are very attentive at teachings and want to learn. They take notes and record the teachings and refer to them later. Buddhism is a path of self-reliance, not one of propitiating an external god or deity to give us material goods, reputation, or spiritual realizations. Tibetans often have statues of protector deities on their altars and store their valuables in the cabinets below. I joke with them that it appears that they pray to the protectors on top of the cabinet to protect the worldly goods inside the cabinet. This is not Buddhist practice, okay? And this is true, you know. There's statues and offerings on the, you know, on the altar, the cabinet below. You put all your valuables in it, and then you make offerings to the protectors and ask them, you know, please may my family be rich, you know, and this and that and the other thing, really, as if they're asking the protectors to protect the goods in the cabinet. And this is one of the things, I mean, that His Holiness, that it concerns him with this one particular protector practice that he speaks about a lot, because he feels that a lot of people are just propitiating this deity in the hopes of, you know, getting worldly things, or even that thinking that this spirit will give them realizations. And so His Holiness is feeling that they're really approaching practice incorrectly. Yeah. Because like he said here, Buddhism is a path of self-reliance. We have to create the causes. It's not about praying to somebody externally, so, you know, they'll do the work and then we'll get the benefit. Expecting an external holy being to remove our suffering and make us a Buddha is a wrong view. Improper understanding of prayers in Tibetan liturgy can lead to this idea. We request to the assembly of holy beings, please grant me blessings to generate compassion. Okay, so it sounds like, you know, please grant me blessings to I want to generate compassion, but I can't do it. I don't know how to do it. So you work some magic, because that's what a blessing is. Isn't a blessing magic? Yeah? So you work some magic, give me that blessing, and then whammo, I'll have compassion and I'll understand emptiness. Yeah? And so the prayers are really worded so that you could easily think that. But that's not the meaning of the prayers, okay? The prayers are worded that way in order to identify the realizations that are really important for us to gain. And then, because we so often put things outside of us, ourselves, we say, please grant me blessings to understand this. What we're really doing is talking to ourselves. Yeah, saying, understanding this is really important. Yeah, may the Buddha, you know, kind of encourage me and inspire me, but I have to do the work. Okay, so it's pointing out the kinds of understandings that we want to cultivate in our mind. That's what these request verses are all about. They're not all about, you know, I'm going to drink tea and just ask the field of merit to, you know, give me some holy water, and then, yeah, I got the realization. So, as Olina says, you know, saying, please grant me blessings to generate compassion, is a skillful way of focusing our energy and identifying what is important. However, we cannot simply make offerings to the gurus and deities, request them to grant us blessings, and then sit back and have a cup of tea thinking they will do all the work. Okay, and I didn't put it in the book, but His Holiness now, when he talks about climate change, he often will kind of talk about God and Buddha having a discussion, you know, because all these people down at Earth, on Earth, are saying, you know, please help us avoid destroying the planet, you know, because of climate change. Please stop climate change. Please stop the pollution. You know, please take care of the Earth so that life can continue. And there, Buddha and God, listening to all the sentient beings, you know, send these requests their way. And Buddha and God look at each other and you know, kind of like, well, what do these guys want? And then they send the message down. You people created the problem. You fix it. You know, you create the causes to fix it. You know? So, you know, I mean, this is very much His Holiness's view. Don't just, you know, pray, do something, okay? So, you know, we hear about, you know, mantras to put around to prevent fire and stuff like that. You know, well, that's fine. But planning and having barricade, doing a dress rehearsal, knowing what to do, having a fire evacuation plan, that's going to work much better, okay? Because you can have all of these other things around, but if you aren't practical and don't do your responsibility, you know, what's going to happen, yeah? Yeah, before the communist Chinese took over Tibet, they did so many pujas. So many pujas. Yeah. And I'm not saying pujas are bad. You create merit when you do pujas. But, yeah, they did pujas, but they weren't very practical. They didn't understand how the how international relationships worked. Yeah, that's the 13th Dalai Lama did, and he sent some people to study and so on. But he didn't have the support in the country to really change and modify things in order to protect the country from being occupied. Yeah. So it's yeah. I mean, pujas help, but you have to create the karma yourself so that the pujas can actually help that karma ripen. You know, you have to have virtue in your mind so that the prayers and dedications and things can have something to work with. It's like you can water the ground all you want, but if you didn't plant the seeds of the flowers, what's going to happen, you know? The Buddhas have such great compassion for sentient beings that if they could have eliminated our suffering and given us realizations, they would have done it by now. Okay. However, our progress along the path depends on our creating the appropriate causes. Our own effort is crucial. Just as another person cannot sleep for us so that we'll feel well rested, no one else can transform our mind for us. Nevertheless, innumerable holy beings are trying to assist and guide us on the path. But do we pay attention to their guidance, the teachings that they give us? Yeah. So here he's really saying, you know, the holy beings are trying to help us. What's the biggest way that the Buddha helps us? Giving us the Dharma teachings. Yeah. The Buddha's speech is the most important aspect of the Buddha in terms of benefiting sentient beings, because it's through the Buddha's speech that he gives the teachings. When we come in contact with the teachings, then we can practice them and gain the realizations and bring about our own liberation and awakening. Yeah. But only doing prayers and, you know, making requests, you know, that's not what's going to do the hard work of transforming your mind. Okay? So, you know, that's why making an effort to learn the teachings, yeah, and think about them and meditate on them, you know, that's, and put them into practice and do purification and create, you know, collection of merit practices as the teaching advises us. So really learning and following the Buddha's guidance, that's what is going to enable the Buddha to bless our mind. Yeah, because the blessings are in the teachings, and we have to find the meaning of the teachings, and finding the meaning of the teachings is the blessing. Yeah, he's going to talk about this in a minute. Okay, the meaning, the actual meaning of the Tibetan words that are translated as blessing. If we call ourselves Buddhists and seek protection from suffering, we should rely on the Buddha's teachings. The principal way the Buddha protects us is by teaching us the Dharma. By putting the teachings into practice, we abandon harmful actions, purify those done in the past, and engage in constructive actions. This is the best protection. Yeah. So yes, we all have cords, right? Yeah. We all have a little stash of mani pills and other kinds of pills. You know, we may have little things of holy water or whatever. Yeah. But we have to protect those physical objects, otherwise they're going to get destroyed. So how are they going to protect our mind if we don't practice? those things can help, but we have to do the basic practice. Yeah. If we do not observe the law of karma and its effects, we may make extensive offerings to protectors, chant innumerable pujas in deep melodic voices, beat drums and ring bells, but misery will still befall us because we have created the cause for it. On the other hand, if we act ethically, even if others try to harm us, they will not succeed because we will have removed the causes that make us vulnerable to it. The Tibetan word jinlab, that is translated as blessing or inspiration, literally means to transform into magnificence or to transform by magnificence. We receive a blessing not through an external power causing us to have an extraordinary experience, but through a combination of the holy being's teachings and our practice. The real sense of blessing is a transformation of mind from an unwholesome state to a wholesome state. Indications that our mind has been inspired and transformed are that our fear lessens, our temper calms, and our tolerance and respect for others increase. Okay? So if you want to know if you've received the blessings of the three jewels, check and see if there's been a transformation in the state of your mind. Doesn't have to be huge transformation. Some transformation. If there's transformation, you've received their blessing. And receiving their blessing comes about through your hard work in your own practice. As a sincere Buddhist, do not seek magnificent mystical experiences to boast about to your friends, but instead try to become a better human being. If you do that, you will automatically benefit others and improve the world. So, some of you have heard me tell the story about when I gave a talk in Hong Kong many years ago. At a school, so there were young children there. One little boy raised his hand. And this was in the days of Uri Geller, remember, who could bend things at a distance. And all. So this little boy, can you bend spoons that are far away? You know, it's like, if you can, you must be really special and holy. And I said to him, no, I can't. But even if I could, I don't think it would make anybody happy. It would probably make them more upset because I bent their spoon and they couldn't use it anymore. Yeah. But it was so cute, you know, because you could see in his mind that that was kind of, you know, what was special. And you can see, I mean, just today, I got a letter from somebody who was going, somebody I don't even know, but who had been going to some temple where they do fortune telling and, you know, promise people green cards and this and that and the other. Of course, you know, you have to make a certain donation for it. But, you know, and this person was saying, is this really correct Buddhist practice? Because I'm beginning to question my faith in Buddhism. And so I wrote back and I said, no, you know, this is not what Buddhist practice is. Because they were saying that they use these worldly things to get people interested in the Dharma. And so kind of like the ends justify the means. So if you promise people worldly goods and they get interested in the Dharma, then is that something good? Yeah. And, you know, so I explained, okay, in the Lotus Sutra, they talk about explaining the Lotus Sutra is really about one final vehicle that everybody will enter, the Mahayana and the Bodhisattva path, but that the Buddha taught the Shravaka and solitary realizer path as final vehicles, even though they aren't, but as a skillful means so that people who thought that full awakening was too high and too vast would start practicing and attain some realizations along the way. And then when they got to arhatship, you know, would come to realize that there's more that to practice and higher attainments to gain. And so I said, you know, that kind of thing is you know, that's not deception and lying. You know, that's trying to present something in a way that somebody can understand and that will help them. And I said, deceiving people and lying and promising worldly things that aren't going to come about, that is not Buddhist practice. And, you know, you can't say the end justifies the means by doing that. Because it really makes other people lose faith. Okay, then the next section, purification and collection of merit. So you can see all these are topics that people come in contact with when they encounter the Dharma, but you don't find them in any of the early teachings in the Lamrim. You know, so that's why this volume is presenting a lot of this kind of material so that people can understand it, you know, before they really delve into the teachings. Okay, so merit is virtuous karma or goodness created by restraining from harmful actions and cultivating constructive ones. It leads to good results in cyclic existence and enriches our mind with positive energy that facilitates gaining spiritual realizations. Merit cannot be seen with our eyes or measured with scientific instruments, yet it acts as a support for both wisdom and faith to grow in our minds and enables our practice to be successful. So the whole idea of merit is really difficult at the beginning. At least I remember for me, it was a very difficult idea. And even the word merit reminded me of, you know, getting little gold stars in third grade. And, you know, that's not the Buddhist idea of merit. And, you know, you please the Buddha, so you got some merit. You know, you got some gold stars on your karma report card or something. It's not like that. Yeah. But when you practice, yeah, and I'm sure some of you have experienced this, as you do purification practice, your feeling about yourself changes. Don't you feel a little bit lighter? You know, you're not so heavy and guilty feeling and regret and remorse. You know, that lessens a bit. When you create merit, yeah, do you feel like you have some, how to describe it? Like some, you have spiritually something underneath you that you're resting on. You're not just floating in space, rather ready to go kerplunk on the ground. But there's, you know, like some kind of spiritual energy in your own mind that, you know, is supporting you and giving you confidence and faith and, you know, resilience to go on. Okay, do you feel that? You know, you can feel the changes because you've put in the effort to really practice the path. Yeah, who was I talking to? It was just today. Who was I sitting next to at lunch? Yeah, huh? You, I'm sitting near you. Anyway, some, I can't remember who, but somebody recently, and it was at lunchtime, was saying to me that, you know, They've known many of the people here from before they ordained. Sarah, that's it. Yeah, and she was saying that she knew many of the people here from before they ordained. And now seeing them as having ordained and having practiced for a number of years, she can see the change in them. Yeah, and that gives her a lot more confidence. Yeah, so, I mean, that is showing that there's been some purification, there's been creation of merit, there's been change and transformation, there's been blessing, okay? Yeah, because she said, you know, I've known many of these people for a long time and what they were like as lay people and how they've changed now. So that's good when people can see that kind of change. Okay. If we lack merit, our efforts to cultivate wisdom may result in a corrupt intelligence that reaches the wrong conclusions. Some people are extremely intelligent, but because they are excessively skeptical and critical, they reflexively criticize reasonable theories and beneficial practices. Nihilistic and cynical, they act in ways that harm themselves and others. Even though they have a lot of intelligence in a worldly way, okay? But they lack merit to use, you know, to use their intelligence to come to correct and beneficial conclusions that, you know, that they can then use to benefit the world. Yeah. So you can see this sometimes, you know, people studying something and then they just come to all sorts of wrong conclusions and that bury themselves in distress as well as adversely affect the people around them. So a lack of merit also impedes integrating the Dharma in our lives. Some Buddhists study the scriptures extensively and are excellent debaters and great logicians. They can explain the meaning of many scriptures, but their knowledge has not transformed their minds, and their everyday conduct lacks discipline. So unfortunately, we see that, don't we? This indicates the corruption of intelligence due to the lack of merit and proper faith. To cultivate wisdom that is capable of transforming our mind, we must accumulate merit and generate faith based on understanding the meaning of the teachings. In ancient India, the great non-Buddhist masters who debated complex issues with the Buddhists must have had well-developed knowledge of the Buddhist view of these topics. Otherwise, they would not have been able to debate them. Okay, so these non-Buddhists understood the Buddhist philosophy. Okay. However, they had no conviction in the veracity of the Buddhist views. Knowledge does not always lead to conviction. Gaining a deep understanding of the Buddha's teaching that goes beyond intellectual comprehension depends on having accumulated merit. Yeah, that's that, you know, because when you create merit, I mean, you're already engaged in transforming your mind and developing good motivations, and so of course that's going to help you. Yeah. I remember some of you may have read Pelden Gyatso's book. Do you remember the name of it? Fire Under the Snow? Is that it? Okay. Anyway, he was incarcerated in the Chinese communist prisons. And he tells a story in his book of one time when some of the communist officials were calling and interrogating some of them. And he tells the story of one Geshe, you know, clearly somebody very, very learned, who when he was being interrogated by this communist official, started crying and begging the communist official not to harm him and not to kill him. And Pelden Gyatso was saying, wow, you know, somebody with that kind of education should have had a stronger mind if they had been practicing the teachings instead of just learning the words. Yeah. So that made a big impression on me. Yeah, practicing and transforming our mind is not easy. Okay? Okay, so we need merit to do that. Purifying ourselves as negativities, destructive actions, and harmful thoughts is also important, done by means of the four opponent powers, regret, taking refuge in generating bodhicitta, that's the second one, resolving not to do the action again, and engaging in remedial behavior. Okay? So by means of those four opponent powers, purification cleanses the mind of impediments. The mind is like a field. Just as we must remove debris from a field and add fertilizer so that the seeds we plant can grow, we perform purification and collect merit so that the seeds of Dharma planted in our minds during teachings can grow into a vast harvest of Dharma realizations. To do that, the great masters advise us to do certain preparatory practices, such as the seven-limb prayer at the beginning of meditations to purify and collect merit. Okay, so this is why we have the seven-limb prayer in so many of our sadhanas. Okay, so these seven limbs are, one, performing prostrations, two, making offerings, three, confessing our misdeeds, four, rejoicing in our own and others' virtue, five, requesting our teachers to teach the Dharma, six, imploring the Buddhas to remain in the world, and seven, dedicating our merit for the awakening of all beings. In addition, some practitioners engage in specific preliminary practices prior to doing tantric retreats in order to accumulate merit. For example, some do 100,000 mandala offerings or recitations of Vajrasattva's mantra. If we do these devotional practices with awareness that the factors composing them, the agent, object, and action, arise dependently, yet are empty of inherent existence, we also cultivate wisdom, which is the ultimate purifying agent. So doing these practices isn't just reciting a whole bunch of mantra and, you know, going to the gym, doing your prostrations on the ground. It's not the, the ritual, yeah, that is the purification and the creation of merit. It's the transformation that occurs in your mind when you do that practice, okay? So, for example, when you're doing prostrations, if your mind is wandering and you're thinking of the latest movie you saw, okay, you know, okay, your body's doing some exercise, your mind's at the cinema, you know, what's happening? It, you know, maybe you're the Buddha's in front of you, you're trying to do something good. So there's some virtue in that, but it's not so much. But if you, you know, really approach doing the prostrations with a sincere mind, and it's like, I really regret my previous wrongdoings, and I really see how I harmed others, how I'm harming myself, how it impedes my practice. I really want to change and transform. I want to become a better person, and and treat other living beings better and not, you know, burden myself and others with my negative actions, and you do it with that kind of motivation, well, then, you know, there's going to be a huge transformation in your mind doing those practices. Okay? So it's not just the ritual. It's how you do it. You know, what's going on in your mind. And as His Holiness is saying here, especially if you think that yourself as the person doing the practice, the action of doing the practice, and the object, you know, the Buddha who you're bowing to or whatever, you know, you're doing, if you think of these three as dependent on each other and thus as empty of inherent existence, then you're cultivating wisdom, you know, the ultimate wisdom, and that wisdom is what really purifies things very, very deeply. Sometimes we feel stuck in our studies and practice. Anybody felt that? The mind is bored, unresponsive, and dull, and we have difficulty understanding Dharma topics and focusing the mind on virtue. At such times, engaging in purification and the collection of merit is very effective to open the mind and make it receptive to the Dharma. So that's like the advice that nun gave me. This is illustrated in the biography of Tsongkhapa. After practicing for many years, he had a meditative vision of Manjushri, the Buddha of wisdom, and was able to converse with him. He consulted Manjushri regarding some difficult points about emptiness. Manjushri answered his questions, but Tsongkhapa still did not understand. Manjushri responded, "There is no way for me to explain it to you in an easier fashion. You will be able to understand only if you enhance your meditation with three factors. First, make heartfelt supplication to your guru, whom you regard as inseparable from your meditational deity. Second, engage in purification practices and accumulate merit. Third, study the treatises written by the great Indian masters and then reflect and meditate on them. With the help of these three, you will have a true insight into emptiness before long." Tsongkhapa then went to do retreat at a hermitage near Olcha. And I was fortunate when I was in Tibet to be able to go to the place where he did the retreat. It was quite remarkable. There he made 3.5 million prostrations, 100,000 to each of the 35 purification Buddhas. And he also made many thousands of mandala offerings. In addition, he made requests to his guru, whom he viewed as having the same nature as his meditational deity. And he continued to study the great treatises as advised by Manjushri. The obstacles to his understanding of emptiness cleared, and he realized the correct view. Similarly, these three can rejuvenate our Dharma practice whenever our mind feels dry or obscured. Okay, good advice. Will we follow it? Okay. So when I was at Kopan, you know, in the early years of my practice, you know, we listened to Lamrim teachings. And then the first retreat that Lama had, well, not necessarily the first, sometimes there were, we did Lamrim retreats or Chenrezi or Tara recitation for a few weeks or something. But the first big retreat was Vajrasattva. Yeah, and he had everybody, you know, first summer you do Vajrasattva, second summer you do Manjushri, yeah, and in the middle you you study and you do Lamrim meditation, and that's how he had us practicing. So it's good, especially when you're young, to do the prostrations, because as you age, it gets harder to do the prostrations. So very good to do when you're young, you know. And then similarly, all the other purification and collection of merit practices, very good to do those.
I wanted to share my experience with creating merit. When I first came to the Abbey, like the pujas really kind of disturbed my mind. I felt like, oh, these people are crazy. What are they doing? You know, I don't understand any of this. Get me out of here. And also, like, just thinking about ordaining, I was like, oh, my God, I'd have some kind of allergic reaction if I put on the robes. And I really had, I see merit as, like, getting used to virtue, developing a taste for virtue.
Yeah.
So that it feels natural and it feels safe and good. And then also at the same time, if you're purifying, you're getting rid of your preference or your taste for non-virtue, because that is also, that was pretty strong when I got here. I'm like, oh, you know, I want to watch a movie or whatever. Like, that's what I was more familiar with. That's what I thought would lead to happiness.
Yeah.
But of course, now I'm not so freaked out by virtuous practices, and it feels like more natural to me. You know?
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like these, I'm faking, or I'm just acting, or I'm, you know, deluding myself. You know, it's like this goodness is real. Mm. You know, there is goodness in the world. Mm. I can transform. You know, it's possible.
Yeah.
So just believing that it's possible to create goodness, I think that's what can be missing if you just have an intellectual understanding. You get the concepts, but it's like, can I actually do that with my life? You sort of have to change who you are and what you're attracted to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very good.
There's sometimes, or often even in Taiwan, we heard the Tibetans practice so much guru devotion, and so here it's also stating that requesting to the guru is one of the merit practices, so to say. And then you told earlier that prayers bring us closer to the teachings, basically, and is that something similar? Why is always the guru practice, or we don't call it guru, we call it reliance on the mentor, spiritual mm-hmm. mentor. Why is that so emphasized, and why does it bring so much merit?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I think the guru yoga practice, it's based on seeing your spiritual mentor as having the same nature as the Buddha. And if you do that, then when you receive teachings, you feel especially close to the Buddha. And you listen to the teachings as if you're listening to the Buddha speak. Yeah. And that really affects your mind differently than if you think, oh, this is just, you know, kind of Norm, you know, Losang Tashi, who just walked in and, you know, he's just like saying this stuff. Yeah. So if you've checked out a teacher, you know the qualities to look for in a good spiritual mentor. You've checked out this teacher over time. And so you've developed some faith based on knowing them and checking out their qualities. Then, you know, if you make these requests and you make offerings and so on, it has this kind of effect on your mind to really open your mind so that, you know, you really feel like you're hearing the teachings from the Buddha. Yeah. And also by, you know, by, again, checking out teachers very well before you form a relationship, and choosing good teachers, then automatically you have respect for them and they become role models for you. And so then when you do requesting prayers, it's kind of what you're saying to yourself is, I want to become like these teachers. You know, you're saying, please inspire my mind. You're really saying, You know, I want to become like you. I want to develop those same qualities because I've seen how those wonderful qualities, how the wonderful Buddha qualities manifest in you, and that is a good role model for me, and I want to become like that. Yeah. So I think it psychologically works in that kind of way.
I think for me the guru practice is difficult almost because of the reliance psychologically. You know, because we see so many places where both in churches, you know, Christian churches and other faith groups, how when the teacher turns out to be flawed, then the underlying faith is so challenged because so much of it relied on the virtues of the teacher. And so there's a part of me that says, no, I want to rely on the teaching itself. Mm-hmm. So that if this teacher, who I respect and love at this moment, but not expecting that person to be flawless.
Right.
And it seems like that's kind of a risk. So that's a scary thing.
This practice of seeing somebody as having the nature of the Buddha is actually a very advanced practice. It should not be taught to beginners. Okay. It's for people who are doing tantric practice. Yeah. It's not for beginners. And, you know, for the reasons that you say, because it can very easily bring about misunderstanding. Yeah. Both, I mean, His Holiness says that if the person is not qualified, then, you know, when it says, see the guru, all the guru's actions is perfect, His Holiness says that can be like poison for both the guru and the student. Yeah. So His Holiness has a very practical approach to all of this. And I think in ancient Tibet, or in old Tibet, prior to 1959, there were fewer things to easily entice people. You know, of course, there's always eight worldly concerns everywhere, okay? But it wasn't like coming to the West and just, you know, sense objects and everything all over the place bombarding you at all times. And so I think, you know, what's happened in the Catholic Church, you know, Buddha scandals, every religion has them. Even places that aren't religious, you know. I mean, I saw this, there was this one, what do you call it, like a political cartoon, and it said, you know, Attorney General's Office for Reporting Sexual Abuse. And there was a policeman out in front saying, this way for the Catholic Church, this way for Jeffrey Epstein. You know, it was a political cartoon. But unfortunately, it's, you know, what's happening. And so that's why it's so important to check the qualities of somebody before forming that relationship, and why it's, you know, this kind of seeing somebody as like the guru is reserved for tantric practice. Yeah. And we have to have our feet on the ground. One thing that we do have to be careful of is we have to discern between if a teacher is acting unethically or if a teacher is just doing something that disagrees with our opinions and preferences. Because there's a big difference between those two. And often we don't make that difference. We think if somebody's doing something that doesn't agree with my preferences and opinions and the way I think things should be done, then they are wrong, they are bad, they are ignorant, they are creating problems, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we often confuse, you know, just people's different ways of thinking and doing things with unethical behavior, and they're really very, very different. You know, if somebody is lying, if somebody is deliberately deceiving, that's one thing. If somebody just makes different choices than you do, and they like to do things in different ways than you like to, or even they hold different political opinions or different social views than you, that's just differences between people. We don't need to get so hung up on, you know, these kinds of things. Yeah. But if somebody's, you know, actually acting unethically and doing something harmful, yeah, then His Holiness says we need to say something.
When I hear you say that in Buddhism, there's not the mandate of if you don't believe this, then you're going to hell. And then sometimes I read passages around like, if you steal just a piece of bread from the Sangha, you'll be in the hell for however many eons. Or if you look at a bodhisattva in a wrong way, you'll go to hell for this. Or so, and I sometimes find it hard to marry those two. I know that it's the karma works whether you believe it or not, but there is still an
I think that they say it. I mean, it's a very simple statement. You know, what's an example? You know, you step over a Dharma book, and that creates negative karma and creates the cause not to meet the Dharma in the future. Okay. Now, there's many different ways of stepping over a Dharma book. There's one way when you're a complete baby beginner and you don't know what's going on and you're just trying to get from point A to point B. Okay? Then there's stepping over a Dharma book with, yes, I have full respect for the Dharma, but you don't connect that the Dharma book is talking about the teachings. So you don't see the book so important, even though you respect the Dharma. And so, you know, you just step over it. Then there is, somebody who maybe has heard that it's, you know, we should treat our Dharma books respectfully, and they've heard the reason why. And they go, oh, this is just rubbish. It's worshiping a book. I'm not going to do that. And they step over the Dharma book. It's another kind of thing. Then there's the person who says Buddhism is rubbish. You know, yeah, I mean, why shouldn't I? I'm going to step on the book because what these people are teaching me is rubbish. Okay, so you have so many different conditions surrounding an action that in the sutras, when they just say do this and you get this result, it's not explaining the whole, all the possible causes and conditions that could surround that. Okay? So we shouldn't take these things too literally and too concretely, but recognize, you know, as with everything, there's a whole situation surrounding any kind of action. Okay? And His Holiness, when I asked him about some of these stories, I asked him about, you know, because you hear, if you say this mantra, five times, you will never be born in the lower realms. You know, and I asked him about it. He said, that's propaganda, you know. If that were really true, why did the Buddha teach 84,000 teachings? Yeah. Why did he give all the teachings about karma and practices to purify and all doing this if all people need to do is say this mantra three times? You know? So he's saying kind of, you know, use your reason. Look at what the Buddha spent doing his life. Yeah. And then you realize, okay, in many sutras they say these kinds of things to encourage people to do some virtue. Because, you know, unless you say this kind of stuff, people won't feel energized to do anything. So, you know, it energizes them and it gets them going in the right direction. But it's not stuff to be taken literally. And he said, similarly, if you say things about positive things, you know, small positive actions, I mean, it has to be equal on both sides. So it's not that doing a small negative action is going to bring a huge result, but doing a small positive action is going to bring a negligible result. You know, he's saying that things have to be equal on both sides. Okay. That doesn't mean that you just take what it says in these sutras and go, oh, well, they're exaggerations, propaganda, I don't need to listen. No, you listen and you can understand why certain actions are to be avoided. Yeah, and because you have confidence that cause and effect works in an ethical way, then you abandon non-virtue and you create virtue.
A few paragraphs back, it says, purifying ourselves of negativities, destructive actions, and harmful thoughts is also important. I've been having a conversation with a couple of people recently around, we talk about purifying the 10 non-virtues or the 10 pathways of action, mm-hmm. but three of those are afflictions.
Mm-hmm.
And in the winter retreat, you made very clear that we don't purify afflictions, we only purify karma.
Mm.
So,
those are afflictions, but they're afflictions that have been developed to a certain point where they can become a pathway of karma. Okay? We do purify afflictions in the sense that if we regret having thoughts that have been developed, thoughts of greed, thoughts of anger, things that have been developed and become pathways of karma, and we regret that and say, I don't want to think like that anymore. I don't want to cultivate those kinds of thoughts. Then you're purifying that. And it's purifying the affliction in the sense that that affliction is becoming a pathway to karma. But what I meant when I said that just purification isn't purifying afflictions is that, you know, just doing prostrations alone is not going to get rid of your afflictions. You have to realize emptiness. So definitely, you know, patterns of afflicted thoughts, yeah, that stick in our mind and twirl around in our mind and motivate, you know, mental action, verbal action, physical action, we should definitely purify those, you know, and have regret and a determination and so on and so forth.